Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as President Obama prepares to escalate the war in Afghanistan, let's ask a couple of uncomfortable questions about that with someone who does that for a living. Mark Danner has been covering U.S. foreign policy for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, and other publications since the Duvaliers left Haiti in the 1980s. He has a massive new book that documents much of that history right up through this year's International Red Cross report that examined in excruciating detail the Bush administration policies of extreme interrogation techniques and secret prisons known as black sites. Let's ask how fully gone those things are as the U.S. prepares for many more Afghan detainees, and recall the days when bin Laden and Ronald Reagan, even bin Laden and Jimmy Carter, believe it or not, were allies in Afghanistan. Mark Danner's book is called Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be back.
We'll get to the Jimmy Carter, Osama bin Laden connection in a minute, but let's begin with these so-called black sites. Remind us of the basics here before I ask you if President Obama is retaining any of them. What do we know as black sites?
Well, shortly after the 9/11 attacks, the CIA established a network of secret prisons that came to be called black sites. They were in Afghanistan, Pakistan, possibly Diego Garcia, Morocco, Poland, Romania, Lithuania, and perhaps several other places that we don't yet know about.
That's a lot of black sites.
Yes, Thailand as well, which I left out. It was this network around the world. It had its own Air Force, a plane that took detainees from one place to another. So one so-called high-value detainee was captured, usually in Afghanistan or Pakistan. Very often this made news, as with the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's going to be tried in New York, of course. And then they slipped off into this black world. We're not heard from again. And very often they were interrogated in one place, perhaps in Thailand, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then flown to another for further interrogation. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, probably was flown to Poland and kept in a prison there. And we've just really quite recently found out about additional sites, one of them in Lithuania, for example. President Obama has said that he has closed these officially. They're not being used anymore. On the other hand, it is true that there are a number of detainees who did go into the secret world whose whereabouts we really don't know now. They seem to have disappeared completely. There's a lot we still don't know about it.
What's an example? Who's an example of a disappeared?
Well, there are a number of them. They're not very prominent. The main detainees, the sort of glorious names that we really know about who are involved in the coal, involved in planning 9/11, these were transferred to Guantanamo. But there are a number of Libyans, for example, a few Yemenis who were picked up and who, so far as we know, have not yet been seen. So whether or not shipped to other prisons or perhaps given to their home governments, we simply don't know. None of these people is particularly well known.
If the U.S. itself during the Bush administration was using techniques considered torture by the International Red Cross, why did they need secret sites? Why did they need secret sites in other countries?
Well, it's a good question. I think that early on, the thought was, and this is my surmise, but based on a good deal of evidence, I think the general thought in the CIA was these people were never going to reemerge. That is, they were going to be interrogated and probably executed. So I think the thought was that they're going in, but they're not coming out again. That generally evolved, of course, until eventually in 2006, President Bush came before the American people. He gave this quite prominent speech out of the White House. in which he described the secret program and described the alternative set of procedures, as he called that, called it, for interrogation, and announced that Abu Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and a number of others were being shifted to Guantanamo. And it's then that they came under the purview of the Red Cross. It's then that they were interviewed. And that's how you got the accounts that I published last spring and also in this book, the original accounts that they gave of their interrogations. But I think originally there really wasn't a plan ever to release these people.
And so do you have indications that the Obama administration will completely abandon the use of black sites or secret sites, or try to use them in some more legitimate way, if there is such a thing, than they were used before?
Well, it's a very good question, and in fact, it's the question. On the one hand, we know that the administration has said quite emphatically that they have closed these things, that they're not being used again. We know that President Obama has said quite emphatically that he's not torturing. But we also know, and I think this is critical, that a lot of the infrastructure remains. I'm talking about not only the physical infrastructure, but the legal infrastructure. That torture has really gone from a kind of anathema, you know, that was clearly illegal in international law, clearly illegal in American domestic law, to, in effect, a policy choice. That a lot of these things that were developed, including the legal reasoning behind what the Bush administration does, still exist. They haven't been officially renounced. They haven't been thrown out. None of the people who wrote them, the policies or implemented them or wrote the legal reasoning, none of them have been punished in any way. Lost their job, even. So,
and hasn't the Obama administration even gone to court, and I wish I could remember what the specific example was, but to defend some of this infrastructure, at least on a legal basis?
Yes, they certainly have. Among other things, they wrote a brief in support of John Yoo, who was the major legal architect of the torture policy and now is a professor at the Law School of the University of California at Berkeley. He's a colleague of mine because I teach there. The Obama administration wrote a brief defending him and his legal reasoning from a lawsuit brought by Jose Padilla, who was the so-called dirty bomber, who was never prosecuted for being a dirty bomber, but who's now in federal prison in Colorado. So this is only one of the occasions in which the Obama Justice Department has come to the defense of Bush policies, and it's rather disturbing.
Mark Danner, foreign policy journalist, author of Stripping Bare the Body: Politics, Violence, War. And your 600-page book has one crucial page that people could make posters of and hang on their walls if they're into this kind of thing. The list made by the International Committee of the Red Cross this year of the 12 extreme interrogation techniques actually used by the Bush administration on so-called high-value detainees. Waterboarding, which they call suffocation by water, is the one we know best, followed by beatings by use of a collar around a detainee's neck and used to forcefully bang the head and body against the wall, prolonged nudity up to several months, other kinds of beatings and kicking, including direct kicking of detainees, cold cells with cold water poured onto the detainee's body in these cells, and more. How many of the 12 have been renounced by the Obama administration?
That's a very good question. They have not renounced these things specifically, although they certainly have said they're not waterboarding anymore, and they're not torturing anymore. We have not gotten a specific, as far as I'm aware, a specific renunciation of these individual techniques. We've simply been told that the CIA will not be using EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques.
So presumably all these things that are on the Red Cross's list are out the window?
Well, the key word in that question is presumably. We're still waiting, really, for a more official. There's a task force developing an interrogation policy. We don't have it yet. We know the military, and this happened during the Bush administration. In fact, on the same day that George Bush gave the speech I referred to, you know, bringing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others out of the black sites, the military announced a new field manual on interrogation, which they specifically prohibited all of these techniques. So the military military has specifically prohibited them. The CIA we have not heard from yet. We haven't had official confirmation. We know they haven't done, or they say they have not done waterboarding in some substantial amount of time. You know, some of the other things you mentioned, the beating and kicking, walling, and so on, we haven't specifically heard about.
And not to have too much of an old debate, but with the exception of waterboarding, simulated drowning, and the beatings, direct beatings of people by collar or just kicking them, a lot of people wouldn't have much sympathy for, say, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed getting interrogated with things on this Red Cross list. Prolonged nudity, sleep deprivation, forced shaving, confinement in a box. None of those are fun, but a lot of people would say, wait a minute, forced shaving is torture? Confining somebody in a box is torture at the level of waterboarding or beating?
Well, I think if they thought a little about the, you know, confining somebody in a box, we're talking about a box that's 3.5 feet high and 3 feet by 2 feet. So a very, very tiny box that they used on Abu Zubaydah. I think people, you know, in some cases, there's a need for empathy here for people to actually take a minute and think what these things actually are. We're also talking about sleep deprivation carried out over several weeks in which very loud noise, very bright light, and very cold temperatures are used to keep the naked detainee awake. So these things, remember, though you list them and though I list them as individual techniques, they're always used in combination. They're not used as single techniques. And, you know, but you bring attention to something I think is really important, which is that the attitudes of the American public have changed about torture and have gotten much more agreeable to torture over the last 8 years. One of, I think, the egregious developments from this policy of the Bush administration. Pew Charitable Trust released a poll the other day in which the number of Americans who said the government should never torture was 25%. One in four said the government should never torture. 54% said it could sometimes or often torture. It was often justified. And what's interesting about this especially is if you look at other countries, Palestinians say the government, two in three Palestinians, 66% say the government should never torture, 54% of Egyptians, 56% of Iranians, and 80%, 4 in 5, of West Europeans. So the United States stands out as a country, or Americans stand out, as a people who are almost uniquely receptive to their government using torture.
Although never, when the question is put as, should the government never torture, and only 25% say yes, that never is a big word, because there's been so much discussion in this country since 9/11 of the ticking time bomb scenario and whether an exception could be made in very, very extreme situations, like with a nuclear bomb possibly about to go off somewhere unless you get the information out of this one guy, things that haven't ever happened in real life maybe, but never is a big word.
Well, I agree with you on that, but it's interesting, though, that, you know, other countries, Europeans, Palestinians, even Iranians, have no trouble talking in terms of never when it comes to torture, but Americans don't. And I'm simply pointing out that that represents a significant change over the last few years.
Right.
And I think part of it is, you know, the discussion, as you say, of the ticking time bomb, which we've had a lot about. I mean, remember that Palestinians, of course, and Europeans are very well acquainted with terrorism. It's not as if they've never experienced it before. They have.
Mark Danner, foreign policy journalist. His new book is called Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. And your book includes a kind of prehistory of the war in Afghanistan that quotes President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, detailing a fascinating and little-known piece of Cold War gamesmanship. And you have this very specifically with quotes by him, talking in 1998, but describing how on July 3, 1979, President Jimmy Carter signed the first directive sending aid to the anti-Soviet Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the precursor of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, that included bin Laden himself once he went over there. Remind us of that history. What were Zbig and Jimmy up to in 1979?
Well, the short answer is Zbigniew Brzezinski was extremely excited about the chance to give the Soviets, as he put it to Carter, their own Vietnam. This is our chance to give the Soviets, give the Russians their own Vietnam. And indeed, that's exactly what they did. They started to pour aid in. The aid, of course, was increased very dramatically under President Reagan. The U.S. continued to support the Mujahideen until the Soviets finally gave up in the late 80s and left. And this gave Osama bin Laden the conviction that their efforts in Afghanistan had destroyed one superpower and could indeed destroy a second. And it's an irony, I think, of the present debate over Afghanistan that clearly one of the goals of the 9/11 attacks was to elicit a response from the United States in which the U.S. would invade Afghanistan and be destroyed there as the Soviets had been. And, of course, the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11 avoided doing that, didn't send in a lot of troops, just mostly used overhead bombing and the alliance with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, in part because they were already looking toward Iraq, toward the invasion of Iraq, which at the end of the day served bin Laden even better. You know, it was a deeply unpopular occupation of a Muslim country that seemed to demonstrate just what Osama bin Laden said about the United States. It's a repressive imperialistic regime that humiliates and tortures Muslims. But it's an irony
Bin Laden used Jimmy Carter's own trick against the United States by attacking us on 9/11 and drawing us into a war that we would get bogged down on and lose a lot of popular Muslim support. That's what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's, I don't know, that's your, using Jimmy Carter's trick. I don't know if Osama bin Laden would put it quite that way. But yeah, that was what the goal was. That's why 2 days before the 9/11 attacks, Osama bin Laden's people assassinated Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the main Northern Alliance military commander, who would have been a key ally of the United States in destroying the Taliban. So all of this was part of their strategy on 9/11, strategy of provocation. And you're right, that was the same strategy of Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter as well.
And reminiscing about the Afghanistan strategy in 1998, as you quoted in your book, Brzezinski asked, "What is most important to the history of the world, some stirred-up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?" Oh, my goodness. Does he admit today to underestimating the importance of, quote, some stirred-up Muslims?
Well, it's a good question. I'm sure, I don't know whether anybody has brought that quote up to him. I'm sure he would not be happy if you quoted him from 1998 saying that, because we've clearly had a lesson in what can be achieved by some stirred-up Muslims, and also that, you know, some policies look much too short-term. In long-term, the stirred-up Muslims have been at least as important, I would say, as the Soviet Empire.
I guess, at least since the fall of the Soviet Empire. But
no question.
You say that the jihadis then welcome the opportunity to defeat the other superpower in Afghanistan as they defeated the Soviets. And it was interesting to me that Secretary of Defense Gates said exactly that himself, but arguing for the war, in his appearance on ABC This Week on Sunday. Listen to Secretary Gates.
This is the place where the jihadists defeated the Soviet Union, one superpower. And they believe their narrative is that it helped create the collapse of the Soviet Union. If they believe that if they can defeat us in Afghanistan, that they then have the opportunity to defeat a second superpower. And it creates huge opportunities for them in that area as well as around the world.
Mark Danner, do you disagree with Secretary Gates that defeating the U.S. in Afghanistan, however that's defined, would create huge opportunities for al-Qaeda in that area as well as around the world?
Well, I think it would be a propaganda victory, but of course it always depends on what we mean by defeat. He's really defining it in such a way that the United States would simply walk out and declare itself vanquished. The Taliban would flow in and reassume control of the country, and the jihadists would, in effect, have control of a state. That would never happen, and that was never conceived of in all of these policy debates about Afghanistan. The debates were more about, do we send more troops or not? What should those troops be doing? There was no option on the table that just envisioned, the U.S. just pulling out completely and handing things over to the Taliban. So I think that's really a straw man that the Secretary of Defense is using in making that argument. I mean, on the other hand, he is right that if there was a complete victory, that would to some degree be a propaganda victory for the jihadists, just the way, by the way, the U.S. leaving Lebanon after the attack on the Marine barracks, leaving quite quickly, and the U.S. pulling out of Somalia after the so-called Black Hawk Down incidents, just as those retreats form part of Osama bin Laden's narrative when he talks about the weakness of the United States. I mean, he draws these conclusions that the U.S. is weak, we can defeat them. Look, they have no staying power. Look how they fled Somalia. Look how they fled Lebanon. Look how they were defeated in Vietnam. So, on the other hand, you can't let the possibilities of the other side's propaganda determine your policy. You have to take note of it, of course, but you can't let it determine what you do.
Foreign policy journalist Mark Danner, you may have read his work over the years in the New York Review of Books, among many other places, and now a collection of his foreign policy reporting pieces, decades worth, and analysis in a 600-page new book called Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. We've just talked about a couple of pieces of it. Mark Danner, thank you very much.
Brian, it's a pleasure. You know, I'm told by my publisher to say I'll be at McNally Jackson Books tonight on Prince Street at 7 talking about Stripping Bare the Body. So the conversation will continue, and thank you very much for having me on.
Got it. Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will get a primary care physician take on the health care reform going through the Senate and the state of primary care in America. In fact, we're going to take calls for our guests from primary care providers, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We're inviting you in if you are a primary care health provider.